Over the time that we've been studying together, we've in various ways mentioned an idea that I think we've got enough background in now to be able to see at a much deeper level. Let's try and explore something we've seen together and try and take it to a new level. Pesach is a time that has two components. The one component is inspiration, and the other is a very difficult component of how to maintain inspiration. The trouble with inspiration is that it only lasts for a moment. A moment of inspiration happens to you, only lasts a moment. Cannot last longer than that. And what happens is after that you get let down. And that's the whole of life, really. The whole of life is one big disappointment after another. The world wasn't designed that way. Before Adam HaRishon did what he did, before the so-called sin of Adam, the world was designed to be a constant inspiration. But now the world is built in such a way that you have first an inspiration and then a letdown. And most people are victims of that letdown. And they spend most of their lives living in the disappointment. Everything's a disappointment. Childhood has promise, and then when you become older, the promise definitely fades. Becoming involved in Yiddishkeit is a very exciting thing, and after you become involved, excitement fades. Teenage years, the same thing. The biggest of them all is marriage. Marriage is a thing that has an unreal, unnatural inspiration in the beginning, and for everybody it fades. People get the feeling that they made a mistake, they married the wrong person, their life is a failure. That's not the attitude one should have. We have to try and understand this idea deeply. We've mentioned it before, but let's try and understand the roots of it. What we want to understand now is not just understanding, as we've tried before, but what we can do about it. What's the pathway that Pesach teaches that a person could extract inspiration, and then he could teach himself how to maintain that level of inspiration? Of course, it doesn't take much imagination to realize that if you could do that, you could function on a superhuman level. If you could function permanently with the excitement of the moment of inspiration, imagine what a marriage would be if it constantly was at the pitch of the most exciting moment that it ever had. Or a friendship. That it would be, you'd have the energy to do anything. Actually, you would have the energy to do anything. And there's a trick that a person can use to access that energy. And if a person can do that, they can maintain that level of inspiration permanently. It's not easy. It takes a lifetime of training. But the root of the idea is contained in the idea of Pesach. Let's try and work it out together. Let me start by telling you a true story that happened to me. And I'll leave you to connect, to see in the end, how the story is an illustration or fits in with what we have to discuss. It once happened to me that I spent some months in Southwest Africa. I once had to spend 6 months in near Windhoek, and somebody there in the Jewish community once came up to me and showed me a photograph. And I very seldom recall, it's hard to imagine having an emotional response to a photograph as strong as I had on that occasion. This was a man who was a traveler. There was a small Jewish community in Windhoek at the time. I think there were 17 families. One of them was a man whose business took him to the far-flung outposts of Southwest Africa, the edge of the desert, places, towns that have long ago ceased to exist, been covered by sand. And on one of his travels, he came to a town which today, at the time he got there, was a ghost town. And in keeping with that spirit, he walked through the town and he walked to the cemetery. The town had a small cemetery. A small town somewhere in the Namib Desert, unnamed town, no longer inhabited. There was there a cemetery. The man walked through the cemetery and he took a photograph of one of the gravestones. And he showed me the photograph. I didn't say anything, he just showed me the picture. The picture was a photograph of a tombstone. But the name on the tomb was Jewish. It was in a non-Jewish cemetery. One isolated name, he noticed because it was definitely a Jewish name. So he took a photograph of the tombstone to show that there was some Jew who somehow had ended up in that far-flung outreach, the edge of the world. He took a picture of that tombstone and he showed me the picture. On the tombstone was engraved the usual information, a birth date, a death date, and a Jewish name. And across the top of the tombstone, engraved, just like the name, with the words written in Hebrew, backwards, kosher lePesach. That's what was engraved on this tombstone. Backwards, the Hebrew letters had been carved. That's what it said. It didn't take much to put together the story. I worked out what must have happened. There was a Jew who was in that town. There was nobody else who was Jewish from hundreds of miles around. He himself either was unmarried, single. There were no Jewish children. There was nobody else besides him. And when he died, the non-Jewish community, whose responsibility it was to bury him, they wanted to put something personal on his tombstone. And they knew that he was Jewish. So they searched in his house for something. And they found something in his house that said Kosher LePesach. They didn't know which way you read it. This way, that way, upside down, the right way. They carved what they saw. Which means that there was a... You have to understand, it means that this Jew lived in a place where he may not have seen a Jew for years. Maybe for decades. But he had something in his house that said Kosher LePesach. He had matzahs. He had something that a non-Jew was able, when searching through his house, to find... that he could that spark of what Pesach is, that has to be discovered in a Jew's life, and it will be discovered one way or the other, either sooner or later. In that story, I don't know anything about that man's life. Whether it was discovered sooner, in which way, I don't know, but it was certainly discovered at that time, and it was there for everyone to see. And that's what everyone of us is going to go through, one way or another. So it pays to try and understand it now. Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, the great Rosh Yeshiva of Mir, when he discussed this subject, he started by quoting some things that are very hard to see how they connect with each other. I'll tell you what he said and how he explained it, and we'll try together to work through this idea, make it relevant to us. He said the following thing. Now I'm going to quote you a few sources that are very puzzling. The first thing is this. When the Exodus from Egypt began, when Hashem commanded Moshe and Aaron to go into Egypt and tell Pharaoh, to let the Jewish people go, there's a problem in a verse. The verse, the pasuk in Chumash, is difficult. The pasuk says this. It says, then Hashem said to Moshe and Aaron, Vayetzaveim, he commanded them, El B'nai Yisrael v'el Paroi, he commanded them to the children of Israel and to Paroi, saying to let my people go, that they should go and release the Jewish people. So if you think about it, the verse doesn't seem to make sense. If you tell me that Hashem commanded Moshe and Aaron to go and tell Paroi to let the Jewish people go, that makes sense. But why does the verse include that he commanded the Jewish people? You follow? The verse says he commanded them, he sort of, how do you say, commended or commanded them to the Jewish people. To the Jewish people and to Paroi, saying to let the people go. So somewhere in there is a hint that something was commanded to the Jewish people. What was commanded to Paroi, we understand, was to let the Jewish people go. But what was the command that the Jewish people were given? So the Gemara Yerushalmi comments on the verse that says as follows. What the Jewish people were commanded at that time was a mitzvah. What mitzvah? The mitzvah of releasing a slave. There's a law in Judaism, as you all know, I'm sure, a Jew is allowed to have a slave. Doesn't mean what one might think it might mean. The Gemara says that if you have a slave, you have a master. Because in Jewish law, you have obligations to your slave. If there's only one bed, the slave sleeps in it, not you. So it's not what we think of conventionally as slavery, but nevertheless, you're allowed to own a slave. But there's a statute in the Torah that after a certain amount of time, you have to set him free. It's in your power to do that, and after a certain number of years, you have to release him. That mitzvah, that a person who owns a slave has to release him after a certain amount of time, is the mitzvah that the Jews were commanded then. Now, that takes understanding. Where did the Gemara see that? All the Pasuk says is that Hashem commanded Moshe and Aaron to Paroi to let the Jewish people go, to let them out of Egypt. Where did the Gemara find in that verse that the Jews were commanded the mitzvah of releasing a slave? They didn't have slaves. They themselves were slaves. This mitzvah that would be activated only many years later, half a century later, when they entered Israel and they started then to have a system where they had their own slaves, would become relevant. So first of all, why was it commanded then? And secondly, where do you see it in the verse? Very problematic. What does it mean? What does it mean? Not only that, but the Yerushalmi goes on to say, a certain Amora in the Yerushalmi, in the Gemara there, goes on to say that it's because the Jews didn't observe that mitzvah, listen to this, that's the source of all our troubles. You hear that? Because we didn't observe that mitzvah properly, let's say as intensely as we should have. Observe the law. But let them observe it as intensely as they should. That law, because Jews weren't as intense about that law of releasing slaves exactly as and when they should have, that's the source of all our troubles, of the whole exile. That's very difficult to understand. What does that mean? We'll come back to this. Try and understand it. There's another source that he quotes that the Gemara says, which is as follows. There was a man, we've mentioned this in other contexts before also. There was a man, a very great man, a man of tremendous spiritual potential. His name was Elazar ben Dordia. Dordia was his name. The Gemara says he was a man with a problem. He was, we have here some young members of the audience, so we'll speak in obliquely. It says that he consorted with women of, let's say, questionable morals, repeatedly. The Gemara, I think, says every woman in the world he married. But every woman in that category. And then, he had this, he was of tremendous spiritual potential, but he had that problem. That was his particular problem, and he did it thoroughly. He explored that area of his personality to the ultimate. That's what it says. One day it says he heard about a certain woman in a certain place who was famous more than anybody else in that area. So he found it necessary to travel to that place. Then the Gemara says that at a certain moment, and I'm not going to tell you exactly, I'm not going to go into the details. The Gemara is not squeamish about the details, I promise you. I'm squeamish about the details. If you look it up, you'll see over there in absolute graphic detail that I wouldn't, certainly in this context, be able to repeat to you. The Gemara says exactly what happened over there in great detail. Don't even ask me privately after. Look at that. She made a comment to him. A certain thing happened. I'm not going to tell you what it was. But she made a comment. And she said to him that you are so far gone that you can't even do tshuva. This woman, you must understand, a person who was as great as he was in the negative side, that means her problem was so intense. Her problem in this area was so intense that she was famous. And she was so evil, so negative, so sold herself in this way. But she was equal to him, and she perceived his personality as only a woman can. And she said to him, that you are beyond redemption. You cannot be saved. You've gone so far that you couldn't even do tshuva. There's no way you can recover yourself. The Gemara says that when he heard those words from her, he was smitten with such a pang of pain, of realization of what he'd come to, that it says he went and sat on a mountaintop and wept until he died. That means the Gemara, I think, if I remember correctly, says he put his head between his knees and he expired. That means his neshama left him. In weeping, his neshama left him and he died. Now, the Gemara says that when Rebbe heard this, about this man and what had happened to him, he started crying. And in his crying, he said that there are people who are so great, because what happened when that man died, the Gemara says a certain voice came out of Shemaim, heaven, a heavenly voice, and announced that Rebbe Elazar ben Dordia had entered the next world. That means he'd entered the state of spiritual perfection. The person with that record had done that. So Rebbe, when he heard that, wept and said that you see there are some people who are very, very negative and they acquire Yesh Koine Olomo Basha'achas. There are those people who can acquire their share in the next world. That means their entire spiritual perfection. Share in the next world is not some sort of childhood image or place. It means to acquire one's total spiritual perfection. It means to reach the level that one was put on this world to reach. There are people who can do that in an instant. Even though they spent their life working in the opposite direction, a moment of realization could put them into the dimension of perfection. And he wept when he said that. Now, there are many things that have to be understood about that story. The first is, and I think we've discussed this before, why did he have to put his head between his knees? Understand, he cried. Why did he have to sit in the mountain? You must understand, when the Gemara tells a story, every detail is significant. Now, it doesn't matter where he sat, if he was filled with remorse. And it doesn't matter where he put his head. But obviously it means something. You can work it out for yourself. A mountain always means, in Torah terms, a place of spiritual greatness. It means an ascent to spiritual perfection. There are commentaries that say putting the head between the knees means a fetal position. It means that he was able to return to the moment of perfection. He was able in that expiration, that means when his neshama left him, he was back in the same position. He was back in the same position that he'd received it in. That's what it means. It means he was able to get right back to the beginning of his creation of his existence, and put back the perfection that he had then. That's what it means. The next problem is, why did Rebbe cry? Well, that's an occasion for great happiness. Here's a man who damaged himself almost irreparably. A very, very insightful woman had branded him as irredeemable. And yet, he'd redeemed himself. That's a remarkable effort of self, a remarkable thing. I mean, it cost him his life. But it was such greatness that he reached that he was able to give his life to achieve perfection. So why was Rebbe crying? That has to be understood. Finally, you seen the connection yet? Don't blame me. Finally, Reb Chaim quoted another Gemara which tells the following story. Again, we'll have to be a little oblique over here, but I'm sure you'll understand. There was a case that happened in Tanakh where a daughter of Saul, Shaul HaMelech, had a daughter who was supposed to be married to David HaMelech, and actually was betrothed and engaged to marry him. But Saul felt that the engagement was null and void, and he engaged her to another man. He actually married her to another man. Palti ben Laish was his name. Shaul married her off to this man, where in fact she actually was already married to David. You follow? Except Shaul did it because he felt that that marriage was null and void. But Palti ben Laish, this man, knew that it wasn't null and void. So he was put in the very difficult situation of being close to a woman whom he knew was forbidden to him. Right? But Saul didn't know that. And the Gemara says that his self-restraint was greater than Boaz, because Boaz had to restrain himself only on one occasion, and this man many, many times. The Gemara says, what did he do to save himself from coming to a problem? The Gemara says that he took a sword and he drove it in between his place of repose and hers. And he said, whoever crosses over this sword deserves death. And because of that, he never sinned and everything worked out fine. Now, the problem with that story, first of all, what's it got to do with everything else we're discussing? Secondly, what is a sword stuck in the ground going to do to prevent somebody who's got a Yetzer Hara to do something that he shouldn't do? But it's not talking about a man, a warrior, standing, holding the sword. We're talking only about an inanimate object that he himself placed there. And what power does that have? And it says that's what saved him. Now, that has to be understood. Now, let's try and explore a very deep mystical idea in Pesach, and we'll be able to come back, it's Hashem, and understand these very interesting sources in the Gemara. The idea of Pesach, there's one thing we can extract from the pathway of what we see in Pesach, is the following thing. You see a pathway of tremendous inspiration and then of tremendous disappointment. That's what we have to understand. We have to understand exactly how that works. We've discussed this in other contexts before. Let's try and see how we can apply it and what we can take out from it. I don't have to remind you of the story, the going out of Egypt, and what the story. After sitting through a Seder, everybody's familiar with the story. But what we wish to emphasize, and by the way, it's no accident that we tried to inspire the children at that moment. It's no accident that that moment of inspiration, which was our inspiration, that means when we got inspired to the point that we committed ourselves to be Hashem's people, at once and for all history, that moment of incredible inspiration, it's that moment we relive, and we relive it in front of the children. There are people who relive it and actually act it out in front of the children. You know that. There are some people who have a custom that when they tell the children about going out of Egypt with the matzahs, they take the matzahs in a pillowcase, and they put it over their shoulder, and the father walks around the room holding the matzahs in a sack. Why? Not to impress him. To impress the children, who when they see a thing enacted, they get tremendously inspired by it. In fact, there's a story even in Chazal that Gideon, the great leader of the Jewish, great warrior, leader of the Jewish people, Gideon, once came face to face with an angel. He was met by an emanation of Hashem. And a remarkable interchange occurred between them. When the Malach appeared in front of him, he said to the Malach, "Where are your signs and wonders? Where are your miracles?" That's what he are. Now, the Mephoshim say that that's very difficult. When a person sees an angel, he's paralyzed into total paralysis. I mean, to see an emanation of Hashem is an experience that if a person knows what he's seeing, and he knew what he was seeing, it's an experience that is so powerful a person is lucky to survive. In fact, the reaction of most people who saw such a thing was that they couldn't survive after that. It's a tremendously powerful moment. Completely smashes a person's own inner being, because one's brought face to face with it. So how did he have the chutzpah? The guts, the courage to face up to an angel and challenge him? And that's the question that the Mephoshim want to know. How did he find it in his heart to challenge an angel and say, where are your signs? Do you know what the answer is? A most amazing answer. The answer is it was the first day of Pesach. That's the answer. What's the meaning of the answer? The meaning is that the night before, he sat at a Seder table. And he heard his father tell the story of the Exodus, of going out of Egypt. And his father had told over, with tremendous excitement and inspiration, a living, vibrant account of the miracles that had happened of the going out of Egypt. And he was so inspired by that, that when he saw an emanation, when he himself came face to face with something tangible of the divine dimension, he immediately wanted to see those signs and wonders. Amazing thing. And it says, many of the commentaries say that that's what you should tell the children. When you go through the Seder, the important thing to tell them is the story of what happened, and that it happened with open miracles. And that we'll see it again. That the final redemption will be like that also, the final stage. So it's a moment of tremendous inspiration. So the story of Pesach is inspiration, and we give it over as inspiration. We try and inspire ourselves. It happens at the moment of inspiration, springtime, which is where the new growth bursts through the ground. That's when it happens. And we do it to new growth. We take children. The whole Seder is dedicated to children. And we try and inspire the child to be inspired for the rest of his life. That's what it is. But you'll notice that what happens after that, after Pesach, is that you have 49 days of Sfiras Omer. And that's not necessarily a positive time. That's a time of very, very difficult time. First of all, negative things happen in that time. It's a time of working through 49 stages. There are people who, as you probably know, if you look in the Siddur, each of the 49 days, you'll see, counts a different midah of the human personality. There are seven basic aspects of human personality. And each one is broken into seven subsections. That's 49 subsections. And there are people who work on each one. Each day they work on the relevant one to try and perfect it. So that after 49 days they've reached through a cycle of having worked on themselves. So it doesn't say that it's a free handout of inspiration. On the contrary, it's a time when there's dafka no inspiration. And then a person has to work on himself very, very hard. Pesach time they didn't have to work on themselves. They just had to sit back and watch. When Hashem appeared in Egypt, he had to be blind not to see it. Right? Even if you didn't want to see, you were forced to see. But afterwards, the 49 days of effort, you weren't given any free handouts of inspiration. That was all work that people had to do. That is the pattern that we have to understand. First, an inspiration, and then taking away of the inspiration and replacing it with hard work. Try and understand that. Of course, what we're trying to get at this evening, now we shouldn't miss the point, is that one has to connect the first with the second. One has to try and carry over the inspiration that's given to you when you don't deserve it, at the beginning of a marriage, or the beginning of life as a child, or a friendship, or a love with Torah, or whatever it is that a person gives himself to. The moment of giving is a tremendous inspiration. It's called the male experience. And to translate that into the female experience, which is taking the inspiration and building it until it's alive. That's the secret. How does one connect the one with the other? That's what we have to discuss this evening. Just give you a wonderful clue. The Svasemis, one of the great mystical thinkers, says that it's part of the secret of why we call the Pesach Seder a Seder. You know, it's very problematic that we call it a Seder. The whole description of what we're talking about is anything but Seder means order. It means normalcy, it means order. Seder means that which goes according to order. And all we talk about over there is miracles, which is out of the order. The word Seder, you follow me? The word Seder means that which proceeds according to the predictable. That's what a Seder is. One, then two, then three, that's a Seder. And what we do is we take a night where we describe the most unordinary, the most extraordinary events that ever happen in the world, and we call that a Seder. You follow? It should be the rest of the year called a Seder. And that one night should be called what's called Chariga. Chariga means leaping out of the Seder. Well, we don't do that. Well, what kind of Jewish idea is this to do this? Rashi MS explains the most wonderful thing, which is that for us, that's the Seder. The rest of the world has a Seder that is Seder. But us, transcendence is the Seder. We live in a world, we're comfortable, we're at home in a world that's transcendent. When the world reveals its inner being, no, not its outer reality, when the world reveals its inner core, that's then we feel at home. Then we fit into, that's called Seder. Then the Jews at home. Then things are going the way they should. It's a wonderful thing. The depth of what he's saying is that one has to take the leaping out of normalcy and preserve that till that becomes normal. That's what one has to do. You have to maintain the inspiration that you arrived at, which is unexplainable, and preserve that until that becomes the norm. Which means that the norm is abnormal. You have to maintain your life at a pitch of excitement that every moment is an inspiration. But that's very, very hard work. It takes very deep training. That's what we have to try and understand. That's what we're trying to... It's only that point that we're trying to understand this evening. You realize, of course, the importance of this. The options are either success or death. It's either take that inspiration and make it last and be successful, or have the inspiration and live the rest of your life in regret and pain that you're a failure, that the inspiration's gone. You can never get back to it. I mean, that's the only two options, the one or the other. And it's in every individual's hand to maintain that inspiration. But it's up to you. If you witness the inspiration and then feel it leave, and then feel yourself dip into the depression that follows, which is a natural process, and you stay stuck there, it'll only get worse. And life is one big depression. But if you know how to take that inspiration and fix it into the neshama, so that the uplift that you got then becomes a normalcy, becomes part of what the neshama can generate, so the rest of your life is an inspiration that's always sparking off more. But that's up to you. The inspiration is given free. You don't have to ask for that. Every child feels inspired. Every teenager feels inspired. Every new relationship and new thing in the world is inspiring. You don't have to do any work to feel that. It's given as a gift. But to translate that into what comes next, that's taken away. It's not a gift. Not a gift, it's taken away. If when you want it to be given, it's taken away. It's only your effort that does that. Try and understand this. Let's look at what happened in Mitzrayim, in Egypt, and see how this pathway unfolds itself in the world. And then we could understand how to use it. I'm not going to go through the details of the story, as I said, but very briefly, just emphasizing the theme that we need to look at. You see that in Mitzrayim, what they saw was inspiration. They saw an inspiration that's impossible to describe. They saw a revelation of divine power that exposed to them the core of the universe, of reality, their own personalities. That means they understood everything they used to understand about the world. It says that they saw more, they saw things that we can't begin to. Let's just, for a moment, try and understand in a vague, vague, distant way what they saw. You know, we've explained this also on a previous occasion, but we'll mention it again. They saw 10, let's just look at this. They saw 10 plagues, right? Esau Makos. They saw 10. It doesn't take any Torah knowledge, I'm sure, to realize that if there were 10 of them, it must have something to do with the 10 commandments and also the 10 sayings that created the world. We have a principle in Torah that if ever you come across the same number anywhere, it means those two things are connected. If you have 3 of a thing and 3 of something else, the one is a reflection of the other. If there are 10 of a thing and anywhere else you find 10, then they're exactly the same thing. That's an absolutely unbending rule. You can take that and never forget it. If there were 10 sayings that created the world, and there were 10 plagues in Egypt, and there were 10 ordeals that the Jews had in the desert, over the next 40 years in the desert, they came up against incredible difficulties where they faced tremendous trials 10 times and failed, if you remember. The golden calf was one, asking for water when they shouldn't have was another. Now, there were 10 times when they... What's the connection between these things? The connection between them is as follows. What they saw exposed to them in Egypt, to understand carefully, especially those who've heard this before from me, because we're going to try and see a new level in it now. What they saw in Mitzrayim, in Egypt, was the following thing. The 10 sayings that created the world, you know, what it means mystically is not just that Hashem spoke 10 times. Mystically what happened was, each of the 10 sayings that Hashem gave forth, which created the world, each one created 1/10 of the spiritual world. You know that the spiritual world, we don't have time to go into details. Maybe, Mitzvah Hashem, during Sphira, we can try and work through the levels in detail. But the world is created out of 10 layers. Are you familiar with that idea? 10 mystical spheres, let's call it. Right? One layer after another. That's the way the mystics conceive of this idea. You can read all this. Don't need to be a Kabbalist to know these things. Today, all this is published even in English, never mind in Hebrew. You can look it up and read all about it. The world is created in 10 spheres, 10 mystical dimensions. Again, it's very dangerous to think of this physically, but it's an abstract concept. Mystically, those spheres start with an infinite center, an infinite point, which has no dimension. It's the point of new creation. It's called Bereshit. It's called in the beginning. It's the transition from nothing to something that created the world. And on that infinite point, which doesn't have a dimension, you have a layer, which is the second. The third is a layer outside of that. The fourth, and so forth, until you have 10 layers which form the entire structure of reality. The 10 plagues, says the Gaon of Vilna, were the following thing. The Jews in Egypt knew that the world had been created in that way. The Egyptians were so perverse that they had contaminated all 10 levels of reality. They were so evil that they had soiled Right? They had driven perversion, contamination, spiritual damage into all 10 layers, levels of reality. So what Hashem did in Egypt to expose the world of spirituality, He sent 10 plagues, each one designed to knock out the imperfection in one of the mystical spheres. Are you with me? Monday night is called Mystical Night. You know that. That's how they advertise it. So you don't mind. I know one person told me he gets a headache from this kind of thing. But this is what happened. So the plagues were sent. Why were there 10 plagues in Egypt? One wasn't enough. One didn't smash Egypt entirely. Why were there 10? Mystically there were 10 because each one came to cleanse a dimension of reality that the Egyptians had toxified, had contaminated. Are you with me? Says the Gaon of Vilna, how do you see it? Most fantastic insight. He said this: how do you cleanse a thing that has been sullied in layers? Let's say you have an onion, which is in layers. The only way you can get to the core, you have to start outside. You can't start with the center. The thing is created from the center out. But when you cleanse it, you must go from the outside in. Because when it's created and everything's pure and open, so you can have an infinite center and then accrete or concrete around that layers. But when you wish to cleanse and you take the thing in front of you, you can't get to the center. First you peel off the most superficial layer. Then the next. And that's why the plagues went in reverse order to the sayings of creation. You hear that? The sayings of creation proceeded according to an order from 1 to 10. The plagues went from 10 down to 1. How do you see it? Think about it. You'll see it. Something you should have seen yourself. What was the first of the sayings of creation? Bereshis. In the beginning. In the beginning. It means the point of beginning. What was the 10th of the plagues? Killing of the firstborn. The firstborn is always the symbol in the spiritual world of new birth. Of something that comes into existence at first. So as opposed to the first saying of creation, which was in the beginning, was the death of the firstborn. What was the second last of the? What was the second saying of creation? Let there be light. What was the second last plague? Darkness. And the Gaon works through all 10, showing you how the plagues, each one, worked against. So what do we see? We see that there was a certain structure in Egypt, and it was blasted open. But that means the essence of reality was blasted. Not just 10 things that happened to give the Egyptians a hard time. It was that the whole essence of the world, the spiritual world, was opened layer after layer. That means that by the time they got to the 10th, the Jews had seen in Egypt the whole spiritual world revealed. As if that's not enough, it says, that what they saw at the sea was many times greater. 7 days later, right, after that time to assimilate that experience. And they went through another process. Actually, there's great mystical secrets here. Very briefly, for those who are with me, it says that they went through 7 days. Don't miss that fact, that it was seven. First 7 days, and then 49 days to Torah. 7 and 49. The 7 days were a culmination. They went out of Egypt after seeing the plagues. They went through 7 days in the desert before they saw the revelation of the splitting of the sea, which the Mephoshim say was many, many times more wonderful than what they saw in Egypt. 200 times more, 250 times more, many, many times greater, such that the lowliest of Jews saw there more than the highest prophet ever saw in the future. What happened? But just before that revelation, there was a cruel letdown. That means the process is always like that. They were lifted to a high in Egypt. They were taken out, redeemed, saved. And just as they came to the sea, it looked like everything had collapsed. Egyptians behind them, the desert on one side, wild animals on another side, the sea in front. They were hemmed in. Why did that happen? Midrash says it was like a king who once came across a young damsel in distress who was being set upon by thugs. Right, who were about to beat her, and she was crying in fear. So the king rode in with his men, and he beat off the attackers, and he saved the girl, and he married her. And what happened was, after the marriage, she started taking him for granted. So he hired a gang of thugs to beat her. And as the thugs were about to beat her, she started crying. He rode in again, and he beat off all the thugs, and he saved her. She said to him, "What's wrong? What's with you?" She said, "I wanted to hear you cry. I wanted to hear you cry for me again, like you cried back then." The Midrash says that's how the Jewish people were. When we cried out to Hashem in Mitzrayim, it was a beautiful sound to Him. Because we recognized Him and we made that connection. But after we've taken out of Egypt, did it get stale? So He put us at the sea, and He made it look impossible again. So we had to cry out again. And we learned how to do that. What happened after that? Then we were saved. But we weren't saved the easy way. Listen carefully. We were saved in Egypt the easy way. There was nothing to do. You sat back and watched it. You saw one plague after another. The slavery ended after the first plague. So we sat back and witnessed the smashing of the Egyptians in the most funny and ironic way. It says that everything they did was turned against them. I'm not going to go into details. But we witnessed the smashing of the tormentors in a way that is impossible for us even to imagine. But after witnessing all of that, we didn't have to do anything. We sat there and watched it. True, we had to make certain preparations. There were misses. But generally, it was after that what happened. We were taken out of Egypt on eagle's wings. And we were brought to the sea. And then what happened was, to be saved then, we had to do a very, very hard thing. It says that when Moshe tried to split the sea didn't split. Hashem said, don't daven to me. Don't cry to me. Go. Walk. So the Jews said, what do you mean walk? There was a sea in front of them. So Hashem said, walk. And only when they walked into the water, and it was up to their nostrils, a man called Nachshon, walked into the sea. He had emunah. It didn't look like it made any sense. That's what emunah means. Emunah is easy when it makes sense. Just to believe in Hashem when he's doing what he's doing in Mitzrayim, that's easy. That's not emunah. Emunah is when you have to do what doesn't look like it makes sense. Hashem said, walk. He walked. He went into the water. Nothing happened. And he walked in the water deeper. Nothing. When the water got up to his nostrils, the sea split. But it was a tremendous test. It meant the only way that redemption came was through tremendous emunah and effort on our part. What happened then? They saw when the sea split much more than they'd seen before. That means this time through their own effort, they merited to see a revelation much greater than what they saw before. They walked through the sea, and what happened then? They were dropped in a desert. And for 49 days they had to walk through a desert and build themselves by working on themselves through the 49 stages of character building until they could come to the Sinai experience, which was the greatest experience that the world ever had. The difference was that what they experienced up to that point was free. Hashem did it for them. What they did from that point on, the 49 stages, was their own effort. It wasn't free. They had to build and perfect themselves and reach a level where they could merit to see Hashem appear directly to them. You see what's going on here? First, listen to how beautiful it is. First, there's an amazing inspiration, which is a free handout. As soon as you begin to get the feeling of the inspiration, it gets taken away, you get dropped in the desert. The desert is a place of spiritual death. It's the exact opposite of what Egypt was. Egypt was flesh pots. The desert was death. A desert in Torah doesn't mean sand. There may have been sand there also. But a desert in Torah means a place where there's no life. It means where all the evil forces of the world are concentrated. That's what the desert was. And they were dropped in that place. But if you think about it, you'll see it's even more beautiful. Because it is a mystical principle that anything that happens must have happened before. Nothing can happen unless it happened once before. So listen what happened. They were inspired in Egypt and dropped in the desert. But if you're thinking about it, that happened before too. Because they were inspired in Egypt, and then after 7 days they were dropped again, and then saved again, and then they were dropped again. You follow? The first was a microcosm of the second. They were taught the whole process by Hashem as they went out. They were inspired in Egypt, they saw tremendous revelation. At the peak of that revelation, they were put in a tremendously difficult situation where they had to cry out again, like that young girl who was saved by the king. After that seemingly impossible situation, they were saved again. So they'd learned now that the pathway was one of a handout, a free experience of inspiration. And then when it reaches its peak, you have to put in effort. That looks like you're about to fail. And when that happens, the sea splits. Armed with that knowledge, they were dropped in the desert. You follow what's going on here? Now they knew. So what did they do? They weren't let down by the fact that they were put in the desert where there was no water, where there was a place of what looked like spiritual death. They knew that that's what life's all about. And they worked on themselves until they actually built themselves to the point where they could receive the Torah. The idea being, as we've discussed many times before, I believe, together, that the inspiration is only there to teach you what you could be. The inspiration in itself is worthless. And it doesn't make any sense. The magic that happens in a new relationship, a marriage, or a friendship, it doesn't make any sense. You haven't even experienced, you don't know anything about that. They haven't shared it, you haven't given anything yet. Where is it? From where does the music play and the bells ring and all that stuff that happens in the... But it's completely unreal. But it's given as if anybody doesn't see this. Anybody who thinks it's an accidental quirk, you know, in the eons of evolutionary development. So in the evolution of the psyche, a couple of genes went crazy and they generated the fact that there's some music plays and bells ring. You need your head read if you think that way. Obviously, anybody with eyes in his head can see that it's a gift that's given to inspire you, and as soon as you're inspired, it's taken away. Why? So now you can build the real thing. That wasn't real. That was just to teach you what you could be, what the relationship could be, what the love could really be. But then you have to get there, through your own effort. And the Jews didn't deserve it in Egypt. They hadn't lifted themselves to that point. they had been smashed to the 49th level of impurity. So Hashem had to save them in a way that they didn't deserve. But then you pay the price. And that's the way Hashem works. He first gives you a salvation or a beginning of an experience or a flexing of your muscles that you can feel who you are or what a relationship could be, which is completely undeserved. And after he's given you that high, immediately takes it away. Because you don't deserve it. And therefore it's not real. And then you have to work on it in such a way that you make a kinyan on it. That means you make it your own. But you never could work on it unless you experienced it once before. This pathway is clear. We've discussed it many times together, that that's the pathway of youth, that a child gets inspired about life, and then it gets taken away when he reaches early adulthood. He's not inspired anymore. The world seems larger than life when you're young. You believe you could be anything, you could do anything. All children and teenagers have that experience. And many people come and they say to me and to others, when they're 30 or 35, men go through this when they get to age 35. That's a classical experience. A man, when he hits age 35, within a few years of that time, usually goes through a terrible, terrible depression. And he'll express it. He'll say that I've died inside. Something's wrong with me. What he means is that when he was 18, he was sure that he would be great. He had an intimation of his own greatness. He could feel his own greatness. And now he's aware that half has gone, 70 years, 35, and he's not great yet. When's it going to happen? But that's the norm. That's the way the world comes. Always is that way. The mystics, there's much more depth to it. You'll see that. If you examine it, you'll see that the whole world is built that way, even down to the tips of your fingers and toes. The mystics say that even when you touch a thing, you only feel the thing as you touch it. But after your finger remains in contact with the thing, you can't feel it anymore. Isn't that right? That's why we feel a thing. Because only by generating change can you feel. If you hear a sound, after you've heard it for a short while, you can't hear the sound anymore. If you smell a smell, is that right? You think it's all accident. If you look at a thing, you don't notice it anymore after a while. Therefore, the whole world you see is built in such a way that the only thing that makes a connection with the neshama is the blast of inspiration as the lights are turned on, and then you don't see it anymore. That's the way the nidda laws, the menstrual separation laws, are a deep, deep mystical manifestation of this phenomenon, which you can work out for yourself. But that's how the world is constructed. It wasn't designed that way, but after we fell into the situation, that's the only way we can generate any. Now, that's the pathway, that's what we learned from Basin. So now let's go back to the things we started with and try and understand. There's much more to explore here. You must go through it yourself. You must look at Chazals. You must see it says that when a baby is unborn, he's taught the whole Torah. And as he's born, he forgets it all. Why do they teach him the whole Torah if they make him forget it? Because he doesn't really forget. He gets driven deep into the subconscious. But he's had it there once before. So a person grows up with a sense of inspiration that there is something inside. He just can't quite get in touch with what it is. Haven't you ever had that feeling? When you get inspired, you go to a talk by somebody who can really inspire you. Or you experience something in the world. Let's say you learn a piece of Torah that really inspires you. Something about nature inspires you. You get a feeling that there's something there that you recognize. Not something that just got put in. Something that you just can't quite remember exactly what it is. That's why they say that when you learn something wonderful about the world, your experience is not that you've learned something. Your experience is that you recognize something. Because actually it is there before. But the whole world is built that way. All the spiritual knowledge is there. All the spiritual power is there. The only thing is, just before you get a real hold of it, they take it away. And then you have to get back there by bringing it all out through your own effort. And then it's real and it's you and it's yours. Now, what does it mean? It means this. That the work, this we've discussed before and I think it should be clear. And if you weren't here when we discussed it before, I would suggest that you get a recording of the previous discussions we had on the subject where we went into it in great detail, so you can understand the pathway thoroughly, especially with regard to marriage, with becoming a Baal Teshuva, with youth and later life, and so forth. Very, very important subject. Let's go back to the sources we began with and see if we can now begin to understand. What Reb Chaim was trying to explain was that when you understand life in this way, you have to understand that there are two phases. There's the phase of excitement and inspiration, and there's the phase of work afterwards. And each one has got a special work that has to be done. This is what we haven't discussed before. There's a special avoida sanefesh. That means there's a special effort that you have to make in your depth of your being that can utilize both of these phases. The work in the first phase is to connect with excitement. You have to feel the excitement, not let it go past. And the work in the second phase is to draw the excitement into the phase that's not exciting and remain inspired. That's much harder to do. To open yourself to the first phase, many people miss it. Many people miss it and you may never have a second chance. There are many sources that say that sometimes a person is not given a second chance at all. There's a roundabout pathway you can use to get a second chance, but it's not easy. Most times you don't have a second chance. You must be very sure that when that opportunity knocks, a person gets inspired. And the second phase, which is much harder, is when it starts to fade, is to be able to hang on to the inspiration. In Shir HaShirim it says that, you know, Shir HaShirim is a love song between a talking. And she says that, "I washed my feet and I lay down in my bed, and as I lay down to sleep I heard my beloved knocking. But I said to myself, I'm tired, and I've washed already, and I hesitated. And then I realized what I was saying, and I got out of bed, and I went and opened the door, and he'd gone." It was too late. And before she was saying that, sometimes the knock only comes once. If you hesitate at that moment of inspiration, if you hesitate when the knock is there, and you know it's for you, you may never hear it again. And the rest of Shir HaShirim, you read it, is running through a dark city, asking the watchman and asking the guards, and where is he? And trying again to find that moment that was offered free. If only she'd have connected with it then. That moment of offer, when the inspiration is offered to you, is only as subtle as a person is capable of understanding. If a person's on a level of greatness, with potential to be inspired, so the hint might be very subtle. It says by Eliyahu and Elisha, when Elisha was a young man plowing in his father's field, he was destined for greatness and he had the power to become a great prophet of the Jewish people, but he wasn't yet at that level. And it says that Eliyahu walked past him, the great prophet, the greatest, possibly the greatest man alive, Elijah, Eliyahu. And he was wearing a cloak, Aderes Eliyahu, the cloak, the cloak that they wore in those days. And as he walked past this young man, he saw his potential, and he allowed his cloak to fall on him. That's all. That's all. As he walked past him, he let his cloak roll over him, and he walked on. But that was enough for Elisha. When he realized that he'd come close to a great man, and there'd been that degree of contact, he dropped everything. It says he burnt the plow, and he made a feast, and he kissed his parents, and he ran, and he became a great prophet. He became one of the greatest people who ever lived. But the only hint he was given, that Eliyahu didn't come up to him and give him a kirub speech. Didn't come and tell him, right? Didn't hack him about going osamach for a few weeks and getting inspired. All he did, he allowed his cloak just to fall, but it was enough. For a man of that greatness, that hint was enough. A person has to watch out for where that hint is, because it may not come again. That's the first level of inspiration. That's what Reb Chaim meant when he said that when Reb Elazar ben Dodia was with a woman, and she told him that he was irredeemable, and he suddenly had a flash of clarity of where he was in the world, he had the greatness to utilize that moment. Anybody else of lesser greatness would have been permanently smashed at that moment. That means he was engaged in an activity of the most utter debasement that a man could undergo. And the cause of the debasement was the one who pointed out to him, right, how low he was. And so low that he was irredeemable. And if there isn't a more powerful moment that could smash a man, I don't know which it could be. But he had the greatness to use that moment as a moment of redemption. It's a remarkable thing. Of course, the message for us is that it's not always a hint. You have to be careful. It's not always a hint that makes things clear, that makes things, that explains your greatness to you. It might be the opposite. But that's a very difficult message to be able to hear. But the happiness of it is that it could be what looks like a permanent blow of absolute, consummate destruction. In that moment, if a person knows how he could extract his redemption, it's a remarkable thing. That's exactly what Judaism is. That's what Torah is. In a moment of what looks to the rest of the world like death, that's where our Seder begins. Remarkable thing. That's what we are. That's how we make a Seder. He took that moment of irredeemable debasement, and he turned it into a moment of redemption. It cost his life. And no question. He gave his life for that. But a voice came out of heaven and said that he'd reached perfection. That's what Reb Chaim meant when he quoted that Gemara. He meant that a person has to know how to take a moment of inspiration. But the beauty of his illustration is that he took a moment of inspiration at the blackest you could imagine. and out of that kind of moment extract inspiration that could be redemption. And it was so powerful that it took him to a sublime. The question we asked after that was, why did Rebbe cry? You remember I said that when Rebbe heard about this great man, Rebbe Elazar, and what he had done and what he'd become, he started crying. And through his tears he said that there are those who can acquire their world in a moment. Why was he crying? So Reb Chaim says this. He wasn't crying for Rebbe Elazar. He certainly wasn't crying for him. That all he had for him was the greatest admiration. He was crying for the rest of humanity. Because he became aware at that moment that it is so rare to find anyone who knows how to latch onto a moment of inspiration that it only can bring forth tears. Reb Chaim illustrated by showing that it says that when we left Egypt and the sea split for us and Amalek was destroyed and the enormous, enormous miracles happened, who came to join the Jewish people? Yisroel. Jethro, you remember the story? Yisroel, it says he saw. He heard. What did he hear? He heard about the splitting of the sea. He heard the destruction of Amalek. He realized who these people were, what a great spiritual people. He realized the truth in the world, and he came to join the Jewish people. Said Reb Chaim, but you know what it means. It's when the Torah tells you that those great things happen in the world, and Yisroel came to join the Jewish people, that's an incredible happiness that a man could realize from a distance and come to that level. But you know what the sadness is? Where was everybody else? Where was everybody else? The rest of the nations heard it also. The whole world heard. The world saw. The Mephoshim say that when the sea split, water split everywhere. The world experienced the plagues. They witnessed, they saw the redemption. When the Red Sea split, water everywhere on earth split. But it says in Midrash, Chazal, it means that everybody on earth experienced the cosmic revelation. But there was no question about the reality. What happened to them? They slunk back. They tried, it says, that the nations came to Bilam and they said, what's going on? And he said, Hashem, Islam, or Yutain, Hashem is giving the Torah to his people. And the nations all said, let's go and receive it. And then Amalek dissuaded them and they all slunk back. And they rejected the opportunity to accept Torah. One man on earth. Isn't that amazing? One man on earth heard and came. So Rebbe cried because he realized that you could expose the world to the most electric experience imaginable, unimaginable. And out of all that inspiration, that only one man will hear. But you have to be that one person. You have to hear that one moment. You have to decide to be that one person. That in your life, when that moment happens, you have to be that one man who comes, even if the rest of the world slinks away. But you have to be able to hear that. The sword that was pierced into the ground between Talti ben Laish and the daughter of Shaul illustrates the second principle. And the second principle is this. The question is, we asked before, what does the sword do to a man who's burning? A man has a heat of passion, his yetzer hara is getting the better of him. So he's going to pay attention to a sword. Yeah, it's like marking a cross on the ground. It marks a line on the ground and he says, you follow? The man who knows he'll be tempted by an ordeal. So he says, I'm going to draw a line over here and I'm not going to step over that. It's going to help? What? It doesn't make any sense at all. It's a very, very deep principle. Very deep principle. And the principle is this. A person has to take an inspiration and he has to actualize it in some way in his life that a sign of that inspiration remains. And that sign has to remind him about the inspiration. He has to make something concrete and tangible that whenever he's in trouble, he'll see that sign when he's weak and it'll remind him and carry him back to the moment of the inspiration so that even though he can't see or feel the power of the inspiration, but he'll be able to generate it of himself. And he has to have enough signs that will carry him through. Reb Chaim mentions that the Gemara says that Ezra, in the days when the Jews came from Babel, Ezra made a special gezeira that Jewish women should wear special garments. You know that? A special sort of an apron. Special sort of a pinafore type of a, some type of a garment that they should wear that should stimulate them to greater modesty. That if they would ever be in a situation where their sneers, their modesty might be challenged, this garment would enable them to be more modest. So the wrong way to understand that Gemara is that, you know, it's an extra garment. So it's another covering, it's more modesty. But of course that's nonsense. Because you follow, a person can be immodest. That doesn't provide a technical barrier to immodesty. What it means is, obviously what he was doing was, he was building into the Jewish people a sign, so that a woman would see that, and a person would remind themselves from that sign to remember what they should remember when it's difficult to do it naturally. The Rambam says, and we've mentioned this before also, that that's the way life is. That life only functions that way. If you wait for the moments of inspiration, you're finished. Because those moments happen when you least expect them, and they happen when you can't use them. The time when you need those experiences is when you're in the deepest trouble. And you aren't given experiences of inspiration over there. In the deep moment of deepest trouble is where you need to call on your own resources. That's the problem. So the Rambam says, the way he describes it most fantastically, he says it's like standing on a dark plain on a stormy night. And as the rain lashes down, you can't see anything. You don't know which way you're going. You're sunk in the mud. You don't know which way is forward, which way is back. Suddenly there's a bolt of lightning. The lightning only lasts for a millisecond. But in that millisecond, everything's clear. It's brighter than day. You see the whole scenery. Everything's clear. The road ahead is clear. Everything is blindingly clear. But as soon as you've grasped the clarity, it disappears. And the progress you make is only from memory. You have to remember what it looked like when the light was there. But you walk when there's no light. Until you finally come aground and you have one more flash of lightning. But they're very few and far between. Elia Lapian used to say that it was like going through a dark, winding river at night in a little boat without oars, and you're drifting along with the current. As you come around the curve in the bank, there's a candle on the bank of the river. And when you pass the candle, everything's light. And as soon as you've seen the light, the boat rounds the next curve in the river and the night is dark again. And the candles are very few. So what he means is this, that the pathway is that you mustn't expect to be inspired often. Very, very, very seldom. You are given a free gift at the beginning of life, as a child, unborn. One is given that tremendous inspiration which is driven deep into the consciousness that a person can tap when he wants to, but it's never going to come out automatically. As a child, you felt that the world was a very good place, and very inspiring place. As a teenager, you were given a gift of feeling that the world was inspiring. At the beginning of a relationship, perhaps the most important one in a person's life, or important relationships, or a new thing that a person took on in career, in Torah, whatever, you give, and then it's all taken away. And a person can't wait to be re-inspired. Because the natural path is that you're not going to get re-inspired. Anybody will tell you who gets involved with Torah, that if they got inspired by a Rebbe, or some piece of writing in Torah, or a teacher, or whatever it was, but after a couple of years of studying the material, it's not inspiring anymore. It's not automatically inspiring, it's just hard work. To extract the depth and the light of the Torah that a person's learning becomes only hard work. But that's the beauty of it. It's when it becomes hard work and a person is able to extract the light, that's when the light is real. It's only just a trick, an illusion in the beginning, just to inspire a person to what could be. And that, finally, is what Reb Chaim meant when he described that the going out of Egypt, the statement that Hashem made to Moshe and Aaron was, go and tell the Jewish people and tell Paroi to let the Jews go. Listen carefully now, it's the most wonderful, wonderful pshat in the Pasuk in Chumash. We'll finish with this. Go and tell Moshe and Aaron, go and tell, I command you to the Jewish people and to Paroi to let the Jews go. Says the Gemara Yerushalmi, the command to Paroi was to let the Jews go. What was the command to the Jewish people? It was the mitzvah to release slaves from slavery, to free slaves after a certain number of years. Explains Reb Chaim, most fantastic explanation. From this you understand how one should understand a piece of Gemara, piece of Torah. You have a statement like that, enigmatic. You have, as I said, an Amora who said that was the source of all our troubles. Nothing could be a greater mystery than that. But listen how beautifully a man of greatness can bring out the depth of a Torah statement. What the Gemara Yerushalmi is telling you is the following idea. Listen carefully, it's the most wonderful thing to understand. And it's a key to understanding many things in Torah. And in the Neshama. Hashem said this, and listen how Torah hides it. Listen how beautifully it hides, weaves into the words. A pshat like this that takes the greatness of a Gemara and a great man like Reb Chaim to explain, to bring out in such simple words what's hidden. The Torah says this, go and command them, command the Jewish people and Paroi to let the Jewish people go, to let the slaves free. You hear that? Go and command. So in those words the Gemara heard the mitzvah to free slaves. Go and tell the Jewish people and Paroi that Paroi should release the Jewish people. Sure, Paro should release the Jewish people. What should the Jewish people do? Release slaves. Just like he should release slaves, the command that you are learning now is that you'll have a mitzvah when you get to the point where you'll be able to own slaves, that after a certain amount of time you'll have to release them. Now why? Why choose that moment to teach that mitzvah? That's a mitzvah that's not relevant now. That's going to be 50 years' time. Because at the moment when you are being released from slavery is the moment when your neshama can absorb the mitzvah of what it means to release a slave. That is the moment of inspiration. And if you don't learn it now, you'll never learn it. If you want to connect to that mitzvah, if you want to connect with the mitzvah of what it means to release a slave, there's only one time the Torah can teach you. So as you're being released from slavery, isn't that amazing? As you're being released from slavery is the moment of what it means as a free gift of inspiration to be released. In the high of that moment, I command you that when you're no longer high and you're in a position that you own somebody else and his freedom is dependent on you, you'll be able to do the mitzvah. Because you'll be able to draw down into your obligation this moment of inspiration. And you could understand from that why it could be that our troubles stem from that. Because if we didn't keep that mitzvah properly, which we were given as a gift, the mitzvah was given to us at the moment when it was so branded in fire on Tana Shomas. We were told at the moment of being released, the mitzvah of releasing. So that mitzvah, if you don't keep that mitzvah, so that could be the cause of all our exile. The message is clear. The message is that when a person has a moment of inspiration, what you have to do, and that illustrates most perfectly the connection. Number one, feel it. Feel it. Feel what it means to be released. Feel, that's what release means. That's what Pesach means when it says freedom. It doesn't mean freedom from Egypt. The mystics say that Mitzrayim is Meitzar Yam. Squeezing in of the 50th level. That's what it is. Mitzrayim is Meitzar Yam. Yam is Yud Mem, which is 50. That means that the experience of the 50th mystical inner being that a person is being squeezed out of existence. And that's what we all need. Not just the Jews back then. We're probably in it worse than they. We're probably in it worse than they were, of having the spiritual dimension crushed. Much worse than they were in that dimension. We might not feel the pain so bad, but we're in it much worse than they were. In that squeeze, that's what we need freedom from. And as you release, right, as you come to a moment of spiritual realization, as someone gives you a free experience of inspiration, as you come across something that's inspiring, so that a person has to understand to first of all feel it. And in that moment of inspiration, he has to immediately make a resolve that this will be carried out into obligation. That means I'm going to take this moment and I'm going to preserve it so that the moment it goes, I'm going to remember. I'm going to make a sign, engrave on my neshama a sign, and I'm going to make a visible sign, and I'm going to remind myself such that when the inspiration leaves me, that sign will remind me. And as I trudge through the mud and the storm at night, when no one's there to help me and there's no lightning to help me, I'll be able to draw out that light myself and remind myself of what it was. And you'll see that's why there's so many mitzvahs of remembering. Every day a person has to remember Yetzias Mitzrayim. You know that? There are people to say, every day, six things you have to remember. The first of the six things you have to say, Leman Tizko es Yoim Tzeischa Meretz Mitzrayim. Every day a Jew has to say to himself, remember going out of Egypt. Does not mean remember historical facts. It means remind yourself of inspiration. It means remind yourself that you are subject to the laws of nature and you looked finite and you broke out of that and became infinite. And remind yourself always of that. That's what it means. Zachor, by the way, means male. Because it's the male experience, as we hinted before. That is what it is. And therefore, what we have to understand from Pesach, we're transitioning now, we're in Pesach. Pesach is a time when inspiration is unbelievable. The mystics say that on Pesach, a person can reach up into the spiritual world by making decisions and by wanting to be inspired, and you can become inspired for free. The mystics say again, I'll repeat it, that during Pesach is a time when all you have to do is want it. All you have to do is feel it. It's there for you to feel. You don't have to work. Free gift. Unlike other times of the year, when you have to work to get there, on Pesach you don't have to work. Because Pesach was a time when it was given when you hadn't worked. You were a slave, and Hashem saved you, without any work that you did on yourself. And it happens every year. We go back, we cycle through time. So when you come to Pesach again every year, you don't have to do any work. It's the most incredible gift. All you have to do is feel the inspiration. Remember what it was like to be a child, to be a teenager, to be a child, to be unborn. Remember that. Go back to that period of excitement, of inspiration. And hold on to that. And then you have to pay the price. When Pesach goes and it's taken away, then you have to start working on it and making reminders and reminding yourself. And every flinch of depression, you have to remind yourself about the inspiration. And every blow that life deals you, you have to remember what it was and how you were going to cope. And that's when you have to pull out the energy that you had in the moment of inspiration. That's what you have to do. What does it mean practically? don't like to speak too practically, but I think people should, if you want my humble opinion, people should make decisions, practical decisions on Pesach. People should decide that they're going to do things that they didn't do before. You should be realistic about it. You shouldn't take on mitzvahs that you know you're going to drop, because there's a punishment for that. You shouldn't misjudge. You should take on things that you haven't done before, but that you can relate to. Not things that you know will be too difficult. Things that are beautiful, that you could find beautiful. And you should start doing them. You should plug into learning. Those who aren't seriously involved in learning must plug into serious learning. Learning is not threatening. It's fantastic. Not that you have to put on tefillin every day if you find that a bind. But an experience where you can get a charge out of the experience. Make the sign something that itself is inspiring. Plug into Jewish learning in a serious way daily, every day and every night. Take on mitzvahs you didn't do before. Take on mitzvahs in whatever way is practical and appropriate for your particular situation, marriage-wise, personal-wise, private life-wise, take it on. A person has to make a resolve, if you want my opinion, to go to Israel. I just got back last week. You have to make a resolve. If you don't go and see that, it's my personal, private, humble opinion that you'll never be anything. If you don't go see people living a Torah way of life where that's the norm, surrounded by the thick layer of cotton wool padding that you have here, you're never going to have a smell of what Torah is. Unless you've lived, for a short while at least, in a Jerusalem, where you've seen families that don't have anything, that the people are lowered to the embarrassment of having to have tattered clothing, Jews, who are all b'nai melachim, it says, princely individuals, that don't have enough, because they're giving it up to learn Torah. See the glow on the faces of little children who almost never have anything new. Little four-year-olds will tell you much more about Judaism than you know. And 10-year-olds, you'll have to strain to understand when a 10-year-old cheder boy explains you something that he's been learning in cheder. See the purity of it and the normality of Jewish life and what it could be. Unencumbered by the padding of a thick wallet or the materialism or all the inconsequential nonsense that surrounds us over here. A person has to at least experience it. I'm not saying you have to go and live there permanently if it's not, you can't adjust it, but you have to at least experience that. And what we're trying to do, and I'll end with this, is we're trying to address these two areas in the following way. In order to help people plug into serious learning, what we're going to try and do, we're going to try and have a Yachai Kala program. It means we'll make a program of learning that everyone can plug into for a certain number, amount of time, let's say 2 or 3 months. It will be a finite amount that everybody has to get through. And when everyone's learned it and prepared it, we hope in Mitzvashim to bring out to South Africa one of the greatest Torah sages in the world today, if not more than one. And we'll be able to sit and be able to understand something of what he's talking about through the effort of having prepared it. And secondly, we'd like to try and arrange, at the end of the year, Mitzvashim, I would like to be personally involved in it, a tour of people who want to go and live for a few weeks, 6 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, live in that atmosphere and see where Torah living is a norm instead of being strange like it is here. See what it means, where tens of thousands of people are living only Torah. See the inspiration and excitement of it and actually get a taste of it. That's what we thought.